Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Sean Hannon. Sean teaches history and the humanities at McEwen University in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and is the author of On Time, Change, History, and Conversion, which came out with Bloomsbury in 2020, and also, with W. Ezekiel Goggin, Mysticism and Materialism in the Wake of German Idealism, which came out with Routledge this year, 2022. Sean, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So today you're here to speak to us about Meister Eckhart.
Correct.
But before we talk about him, let's talk a little bit more about you. How did you find yourself studying mysticism?
Well, I actually began my academic trajectory focused more on late antiquity than the Middle Ages, and more specifically on the history of the philosophy of time, which naturally brought me to Augustine of Hippo and some of the weird things he says about temporality in Book 11 of the Confessions. And yeah, I was more interested in connecting him to figures from the Neoplatonic tradition, like Plotinus, who also says some weird things about time and eternity in Ennead 3.7. And that's where I started in undergrad and what kind of brought me into grad school. And that first book that you mentioned, On Time, Change, History, and Conversion, is part of Bloomsbury's Reading Augustine series, which is all about trying to connect Augustine to sort of interestingly bizarre modern connections that can maybe make him a little more accessible to the 21st century reader. But my advisor in grad school was Dr. Wilhelmine Otten, who's a scholar of John Scotus Eriugena and the 12th century Renaissance and Emerson and the Transcendentalists. She has wide-ranging interests as well. And it was through her and taking her courses and just working with her at Chicago that I got introduced to the world of the medieval mystics, primarily through visionary women like Hildegard of Bingen. So there's your 12th century Renaissance. Hadovich, right? The Beguine tradition, which I'm sure you know more about than I do. Marguerite Perret, especially. And then from Perret into Meister Eckhart, because there are a lot of interesting parallels in the way that Marguerite and Eckhart discuss self-annihilation and kenosis and all of these kind of technical concepts and terms from contemplative theology. So that was my initial connection. And I remember Professor Otten even saying, why don't you think about connecting some of the issues you're discussing with regard to temporality in Augustine to a medieval figure like Eckhart, right? Is there a tradition there? Is there a radical difference between what Augustine says about time versus what Eckhart says about time? Maybe go in that direction. And so I started going in that direction. Through that, I started going more to medieval conferences like Kalamazoo. And through that, I got connected to the American Cusanus Society, of which I'm now the secretary, which is devoted to the study of Nicholas of Cusa, but also more generally to high and late medieval and early modern intellectual history, and to a degree, contemplative or mystical thought. And once I got involved with the Cusanus Society, then again, my interest and ability to study mysticism and write about it, I think, expanded to some degree. And that led to the other book you mentioned, which is my collaboration with my good friend, Zeke Goggin, where we tried to look at the afterlife of figures like Meister Eckhart all the way down to the 19th and 20th centuries in German idealism and romanticism and in all sorts of fascinating modern traditions. So I think that mostly sums up my trajectory so far.
And those who have caught up on their episodes of this podcast will remember in episode 34, Sam Doubleman singing the praises of the Cusanus Society, and can look forward to Zeke Goggin appearing on our next episode. So it's a little preview of some of the things we might end up talking about next week as well. I'm actually really interested on this idea of temporality and looking for that in Eckhart. Did that prove a fruitful area of investigation?
Yes, although maybe not in the way that I expected. One of the things that I found most surprising when I first read Book 11 of the Confessions was all of the things that Augustine says about the present time or the present moment, which can be read as him expressing a sort of skepticism about the reality or integrity of that present moment. And to read him in that way would produce a kind of anti-presentist philosophy of time, basically an understanding of temporality that doesn't make the now or the present moment the most real part of the stream of time or the river of time, the flux, whatever you want to call it. And I thought that was fascinating because I had, even in my scattered reading, I had come across more present focused accounts of temporality. I had done some work in phenomenology, right? So coming out of Husserlian phenomenology, and then you have Paul Ricoeur, who's doing phenomenology of time, but going back to Augustine as well. So they seem to be really obsessing over this present moment. And so I decided to go back and read Augustine and figure out what he was sort of saying about it. And the reading that I arrived at, which not everyone agrees with, and that's fun, is that he is pretty skeptical about the present moment, and he doesn't want to make the now this kind of privileged core of reality. And he doesn't think that we should dwell in the moment or be in the now as if that would provide some sort of salvific effect for us or something like that. So originally, when I started looking at what Eckhart says about time, I was a little weirded out in a different way, because he does talk a lot about the now, right? And he has a lot to say about what we mean when we use terms. Here we're talking about Middle High German terms, like new being translated into the English now. And he has a lot to say about how that connects not just to our own experience of time, but also to our sense of what divine timelessness or eternity is. So the first thing I noticed was that Augustine, kind of skeptical about making the present the star of the show. Eckhart does want to make the now the star of the show. So maybe these are just two radically different traditions within ancient and medieval Latin Christianity, broadly construed. The end, right? Maybe that's the end of the story. Obviously, going back to Eckhart's sermons again and again, trying to track and catalog and compile all the different things he says about the now, and again, how those comments about the now would be read by modern philosophers, like the idealists, like the phenomenologists, and so on, obviously led to a more nuanced understanding, I hope, of what's going on in Eckhart. And so now I would say that Eckhart and Augustine certainly don't agree 100% on issues regarding the philosophy of time. But I do think there are some connections we could draw rooted in how they think of temporality and atemporality that could explain both why Augustine is skeptical of the present and why Eckhart wants us to focus on the now properly understood.
And the point you're making is actually a really interesting one. You're saying people might disagree with your interpretations of Eckhart. Eckhart and Augustine would have disagreed with each other. Any group of historians, philosophers, theologians, what have you, we don't just agree on things. You can't just write all historians say, because we don't. We don't agree on anything.
I agree.
Oh no, what have we done?
But I have some quotes on the now.
Fantastic. Tell me about the now.
All right. So these are some quotations that I believe are all from Sermon 8 of Eckhart. And that's according to the Walsh numbering. As you may already know, there's the Walsh numbering of Eckhart's sermons, and then there's the Josef Kvint older sermon numbering. And you find both, in depending on what kind of scholarship you're reading and if you're looking at Anglo-American versus German. So it can get confusing. But this is, I believe, Sermon 8, based on the Walsh numbering, which is the version that Bernard McGinn, whose work has been incredibly influential upon me, McGinn basically takes Walsh's translations and reworks them and amends them. So it's that Walsh-McGinn trajectory that I'm mostly working with here. And these are also quotations that we discuss in chapter 2 of our book on mysticism and German idealism, because, as I said before, one of the things that attracts some figures from that era of modern idealism and romanticism, like Franz Xaver von Baader, one of the things that attracts them to Eckhart is this focus on the now and certain ideas about temporal experience or experiences that humans could have within temporality that might sort of lift them out of the everyday flow of time. And I'm not saying that's how Eckhart should necessarily be read, but that's what many modern thinkers find in Eckhart. So some quotations from Sermon 8. And yet, says Eckhart, all attachment, Eigenschaft, to any work that involves the loss of freedom to wait on God in the here and now, in diesem gegenwärtigen Nu, as if you had nothing else and neither would nor could do otherwise, any such attachment or set practice could only deny you this freedom. And then a little bit lower, longer explanation now. For the now in which God made the first man, and the now in which the last man shall cease to be, and the now I speak in, all are the same in God, and there is but one now. That's probably the best quotation to capture the type of thing that Eckhart likes to say about the now. And you can imagine all the different ways that could be interpreted and debated over the intervening centuries. And then one more for you. Again, this one's a little bit longer and in some ways a little bit more confusing. Quote, if a man's spirit were always united with God in this power, he would not age. Observe, this man dwells in one light with God, having no suffering and no sequence of time, but one equal eternity. This man is bereft of wonderment, and all things are in him in their essence. Therefore, nothing new comes to him from future things, nor any accident, for he dwells in the now, ever new and without intermission. End quote. Nothing new comes to him, for he dwells in the now, ever new. Right? So there's a bit of a paradoxical tone to that rhetoric. But I think those three quotes give you at least the flavor of Eckhart's rhetoric of the mystical now, which is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the hermeneutical story, because now we get to argue about, you know, is he making a statement rooted in the philosophy of time? Is he making a statement about a presentist doctrine of how time really works? Or is all of the mystical now rhetoric just in the service of cultivating a kind of experience in the listener? And perhaps we're barking up the wrong tree by trying to map Eckhart out in terms of this long Neoplatonic debate going back to Plotinus and Augustine about how precisely time is structured.
I feel like when it comes to interpreting Eckhart, there is a lot of room for argument in a lot of ways, because he doesn't write simplistically. We don't have a lot of really clear, direct explanations of what he's saying and what he means. There is a lot that's left up to peeling through the layers. Similarly, in a lot of ways, to Marguerite Porrette, which is one of the reasons that they potentially both got in a little bit of trouble, her more than him, but, you know, both of them coming into conflict about the things that they wrote.
Absolutely. No, I think that the way I approach Eckhart, I'll admit, is largely in terms of, again, this sort of history of philosophy angle. So I'm always looking for the ideas and the concepts and the arguments, more so than mapping out the biography. But yeah, it's important to remember that we kind of don't really know what happens to Eckhart, right? He just sort of disappears around 1328. We know he's being investigated, and we know that there are, I believe, 28 propositions attributed to him that get condemned. I think it's like 17 are really condemned and 11 are sort of mildly condemned. He himself is not condemned, certainly not all of his works, and there's a case to be made for his full rehabilitation from that vantage point. But yeah, I think one of the reasons he gets in hot water, and in some ways it parallels what happened with Marguerite Porrette, is not just the ideas that they're expressing, which in many ways can almost always be explained if you look back at the history of Neoplatonic thought and what other less controversial thinkers said about how the human being can approach the divine through some kind of intellectual ascent that may involve the diminishment of our sense of self and the overcoming of images that we have of the divine, right? So you can have all that good stuff, but it seems like what makes it controversial is the manner in which you share those ideas, right? And we know Marguerite was great about sharing her own ideas broadly, and Eckhart as well, right? There's a little bit of debate about who made up the precise audience of any given sermon by Eckhart, right? You can really get into the weeds there. But in general, just the fact that they're in the vernacular and he's just kind of, for lack of a better phrase, throwing these ideas out there, right? He's not just reserving them for his scholastic works, because he had those too, right? He has all these Latin works. He's a trained scholastic thinker, but he's not just going to reserve some of those more challenging ideas about unity with the divine or something like that. He's not just going to reserve those for the back pages of some scholastic treatise. He's just going to work them into his sermon, right? Which is only a couple pages long. And he'll throw around all this technical terminology like Grund, right? We share the same ground as God. He's always saying that. The citadel, right? We have to go into our inner citadel. The spark, which is especially controversial given the history of that idea of sort of an inner light. And he'll just weave them in to his exegeses of scripture in ways that boggle the mind. Usually when you see, okay, he's supposed to be talking about Mary and Martha in Luke 10, but what he's saying about the meaning of that passage seems to flip on its head what you'd expect someone in that context to say. And he's willing to bring in these terms that he's not getting from that particular scriptural passage, at least, and give them this pride of place in his exegesis. Yeah. And I think that kind of move is what can get you into a little bit more trouble, I would think.
I mean, you can't just go telling your ideas to anyone. Then they get ideas and think that they don't really need you. And then it's just work, work, work. Let's backtrack, though, because this is our first episode on Meister Eckhart. Let's talk a little bit more about him and who he was. What do we know about his life and biography?
Sure. So Eckhart is essentially a much younger contemporary of folks like Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas, right? So if Eckhart as best we know, he was born in 1260. And Aquinas dies in 1274. Albert dies in 1280, even though he's older than Aquinas. Albert's probably the more direct connection to Eckhart, because it seems like Eckhart entered the Dominican order at a fairly youthful age and was trained at the Studium in Cologne. And that Studium was clearly associated with Albert. The way I sometimes think of it is Albert the Great is sort of this font of 13th century Dominican intellectual life on every topic, from philosophical abstraction to theological doctrine to alchemy and natural sciences, right? It's all kind of coming down from Albert. And then you have these different Dominicans picking up different aspects and taking them off in their own directions, right? So Aquinas picks up a certain type of rational exploration from Albert and takes that to its logical conclusion. Eckhart picks up on some other elements of Albert's Neoplatonic speculations and takes them in his own kind of contemplative direction, and again, disseminates those ideas to different sorts of audiences. So he comes out of that German dialect speaking Dominican milieu of the late 13th century, bounces around a bit, studies at Paris for a bit, works a lot at various convents associated with the Dominican order in places like Erfurt and later Strasbourg. He teaches at Paris for a while. And then sometime in the middle of the 1320s, the investigations against him sort of pick up speed, right? There's definitely some suspicion of him earlier than that, but that's really when things start to pick up speed. And it seems like he died sometime around 1328, probably on his way to Avignon, where the papal court was located, to explain himself to the authorities there, and ultimately to Pope John the 22nd, the same pope who gets into a bit of a conflict with Ludwig of Bavaria, William of Ockham, Marsilius of Padua, Michael of Cesena, head of the Franciscan order. So it's a pretty tumultuous era for all of these thinkers and their relation to the papacy. And it all sort of culminates in 1329 with the papal bull in Agro Dominico, which is where you get clarification of what exactly was supposed to be wrong with Eckhart. And that kind of leads to Eckhart's legacy being still quite alive, but checkered and controversial going forward, because anyone who wants to build off of Eckhart, for example, Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa in the 15th century will build off of Eckhart, but he'll do so in a way that aims to avoid drawing that same negative attention. So that's, again, very minor biographical detail, but that's a general picture of Eckhart's life and times.
And while with some mystics, all we end up left with is hagiographies written by other parties, we actually have a lot of Eckhart's own writings. So can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things he wrote and what he talked about?
Yeah, so I will admit that I mostly am drawn to the sermons. It's that pithy character. It's the boldness and strangeness of the exegesis. It's the fact that he, again, is sharing these ideas with audiences that we might not expect they'd be shared with. But I would not want to leave anyone with the impression that the Middle High German sermons represent anything like the totality of his output. There's lots of modern translations. I like the classics of Western spirituality. They have two volumes on Eckhart, and they cover a much wider swath of writing. So, for example, he wrote a lot in Latin, works that we would probably describe as fairly scholastic, often commentaries on books of scripture. And then you have non-sermon works like the Book of Divine Consolation, which I think proved to be particularly controversial when Eckhart was being investigated. So he really did cover a lot of different genres. The author slash text that I usually kind of contrast with Eckhart in my head is the Cloud author, right? So Cloud of Unknowing has some pretty critical passages about any kind of intellective Dionysianism or a kind of scholastic ascent of reason as something you would have to do before you take the next step into affective contemplation or a kind of ecstatic experience of union with the divine. Eckhart, I put on the other end of the spectrum. Yes, he's trying in a way to be accessible and get these ideas out to people. But at the same time, I think he does want folks to think, right? He does kind of preserve a little bit of that scholastic influence he gets from all of his training and his teaching, right? That's still kind of one major part of the world that he operates in. So more so than some other thinkers, I guess what I would say is that you can think of Eckhart as having one foot in that scholastic stream and one foot in this more popular contemplative stream. And I don't think he sees those as necessarily rivals or in any way mutually exclusive, whereas some other late medieval mystics would see them as perhaps conflicting and you kind of have to pick one or the other. I think with Eckhart, you kind of don't. And the vast output of his writings across different genres, I think, just serves as an example of how he operates in those two worlds at the same time.
Does he cover similar topics across genres? I mean, sermons tend to be scriptural exegesis, but does he end up covering a lot of the same ideas and themes?
In general, I think, you know, he will explore similar ideas in different genres, but he'll place emphasis in different ways. Because again, it's writing for different audiences. If you're trying to convince a fellow Dominican scholastic that your reading of this book of scripture is plausible on some level of intellectual interpretation, then you're going to lean in certain directions. If you're speaking to a different sort of audience in a sermon, it's going to be a little bit different. One other thing that kind of makes Eckhart a little bit different is that he doesn't talk a lot about his own quote unquote mystical experiences, right? So that's very different than a lot of visionaries who the whole point is, let's recount the vision and then let's maybe perform exegesis upon the very vision that I just had. And the great thing about that is you get almost like a autobiographical reflection on what it is like to have a visionary experience or what it is like to try to pursue some of these mystical practices, like dying to yourself or annihilating your sense of self or performing kenosis, that is emptying out your sense of self so that all that is left is the grunt or ground that you share with God. So Eckhart will use all of that technical language I just used, but he doesn't render it completely autobiographical. There are a few passages that some people think, you know, he'll say, you know, this may have happened to somebody I know. Right. And it's like, oh, he's doing that thing that Paul does where he talks about it in the third person, but actually means himself. But we don't know that for sure. Right. And it seems like he kind of wants to keep his cards close to his chest. Right. Doesn't necessarily want to lay out on the table exactly what may have happened to him. And so folks have speculated on that. But in general, it seems like he's more interested in occasioning a certain kind of reaction and experience in his audience rather than just talking about what is already happen to him or become possible for him. So that's how I would make sense of some of the ideas, again, that he's communicating in these sermons. Does he necessarily say, when I go back to the fundamental ground, or when I go into the citadel, this is what I see, or when I find the spark within? It's more about, can he get the audience to undergo this experience using all of these different images, all of which are meant to point beyond themselves? This is something that I talked a lot about with Zeke Gogg and my co-author, was what is exactly going on with images in Eckhart's sermons? Because he's using them all the time. And that makes sense. If you're trying to communicate a point, you'll use imagery, analogy, and so on. But one of the main points he's trying to get across is that we must detach. There's another good Eckhart term we haven't got to yet. Detach from, let go of all images. And so there's kind of this weird thing where he's using the images to invite us to climb up each rung of the ladder, kind of intellectual ascent. But once you pass to the next rung, you leave the last one behind, right? You leave the last image behind. And ultimately, you're supposed to arrive to a place without images. And that the image of the ground is meant to signify that, right? A place where there aren't any images left. No image of what you think God is. No image of what you think you yourself are. Certainly no images of external objects, but a kind of imageless foundation. And that kind of self-annihilation, that sense of nothingness, that emptying out, is essentially what unio mystica, or mystical union with the divine, looks and or feels like for Eckhart.
Wow. Okay, so it's much more about guidance and the emptying out of the self. And is that the goal, to just become as much nothing as you can be? And what's the end game on that?
I would say, yes, that's how I read the goal. And again, nobody really agrees about this stuff. And I could totally see other interpreters of Eckhart saying that I might be pushing it too far to one side and we have to look at other things he says. But I would say that, yes, my reading of the vast majority of Eckhart's sermons is that he's pushing us toward a kind of nothingness, a kind of kenosis and emptying, where we no longer have the basically false idols of who we think we are, right? We can no longer rely on those. And so it's very similar to just good old-fashioned negative theology, where we have to smash not just physical idols, but intellectual idols that we have of God. God is my judge. God is my teacher, right? All of those kind of have to get crossed out and superseded. Same thing with ourselves, right? I am this kind of person. I come from this part of the world. I come from this sort of family. I care more about these people in my close proximity than I do about people living far away. All of that kind of stuff really has to be smashed, or again, detached from, through these processes. Just to get a few more technical terms out there, there's Gelassenheit, which sometimes in the past was translated as detachment, but is often translated now as releasement. But it has that same idea of letting go. I would recommend the work of Ian Alexander Moore, who is good on Gelassenheit and its philosophical legacy after Eckhart. Again, 20th century philosophers are really going to pick up on that idea as well. And then there's also, depending on how you pronounce it, modern German, Middle High German, Abgeschiedenheit or Abgeschiedenheit is probably what we should translate more directly as detachment. But without getting into the weeds of the exact difference between those two, we can probably just take them as a general sense of letting go that begins with the kind of letting go of attachments to worldly things that you get pretty commonly throughout medieval Latin Christianity, but then extends much further to detaching from attachments to self and to God, which is one of the more controversial sort of statements that someone like Eckhart might make. Now, what is the end game here? Sometimes we read Eckhart as though the end game is a kind of meditative state. Eckhart is often read in kind of like a wider, for lack of a better adjective, new agey setting, right? Where it is a kind of meditative state that we're sort of looking for. Another way of reading Eckhart, and this is something that you find in the work of, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right, Alex Dubilet, is a reading of Eckhart that is pushing him in the direction of immanence. So it's not about a kind of meditative withdrawal, really, even though it can kind of sound like that. It's about a kind of transformation that you undergo that then allows you to live in the world, like this material world, the immanent world, in a different way. And then the debate becomes, okay, well, what changed, right? Because if you're not withdrawing to the cloister, Eckhart is very happy to mock his cloistered friends in the Benedictines and other orders. But if you're essentially still living in the world and doing your daily work, has anything changed? What kind of change are we talking about here? And so I agree, in a sense, that we should see the end game for Eckhart being a transformation that affects this material world. I'm not sure I would follow all of those contemporary readers who discuss these things, because they kind of come out of a tradition of figures like Deleuze and how they use immanence. And that's just kind of not the world I come out of. And so I can't really speculate about it. But, and this comes up again in the book I wrote with Zeke, the whole materialism thing, I do think that ultimately Eckhart is talking about a transformation that will affect people's day-to-day lives.
Which might in part explain why he does speak to such a broad audience and writes in all these different ways.
Yeah, so this isn't about a meditative state that only the most trained of the trained theologians could attempt, right? This hopefully should be something that folks who have to go out and do their work every day, they can have that experience too. And it might actually change their relationship to their own labor, right? To their own work.
Okay, can you give an idea of how that works in a practical sense?
So I mentioned before this idea that one of the most pernicious senses of attachment that we have, even though we don't necessarily think of it as pernicious, is essentially a kind of bias of proximity, right? That the person in my household or the person down the street is more my sibling or is more my neighbor than the person on the other side of the world. And Eckhart explicitly rules that out. And he draws a direct connection between overcoming selfhood, overcoming this illusion of who we are, and a kind of opening up of ourselves to the most distant neighbor, right? The other human being that we may have never heard of from a totally different culture and location. Somehow your overcoming of your own selfhood will allow you to kind of be part of this human family with them in a way that you wouldn't have been able to be if you held on to this idea of a self. One of the things we talk about in the book as well is how some mystics are appropriated in the 19th and 20th centuries by nationalists. This happens with Eckhart. This happens with Catherine of Siena. In both of those cases, it's not just garden variety nationalism. It's nationalism that's becoming fascism. And so one of the things we want to do is push back against that and say, well, no, actually, if you look at what they're saying, especially these passages from Eckhart, it's the opposite of nationalism. The self-overcoming is meant to explode all of these attachments that we have. And guess what? Nationalism, just another one of those attachments. There may be some piece of private property you have that you really, really love. You shouldn't feel too attached to that. Same thing goes for a national identity or the idea of the nation state, right? You might think that that is the sacrosanct relationship you have that structures your sense of identity and self. Eckhart says no, right? That's one of the other idols that has to be smashed.
And with that, the definition of the self is often made in comparison to the recognition of some sort of other.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting rid of the self, then you're also getting rid of the other and opening yourself up to the idea that there is only one universal humanity and that any other ways of delineating between people are human and not of God and therefore need to be rejected. So you not only lose the ostracization of other people, you also lose all sense of self-identity and therefore, I suppose, become nothing.
That's right. And there is a risk that if we interpret Eckhart in this way, it essentially becomes a universalizing project, right? Well, there's no self. Okay, fine. But there's also no other. And so it's kind of like everything is being drawn into the same universal category. And that could be bad, right? There are certain contexts in which we don't really want to lean into that kind of rhetoric or that way of thinking. But if I'm pressed to say, what do I think is going on in Eckhart? It is a kind of Christian universalism, at least in those passages. Now, it's a Christian universalism that aims to be open to like non-Christian peoples and communities, but it is still kind of rooted in this idea that there's one line of thinking here that if we follow it all the way through to its end, it kind of will include everybody and account for everything. So if we want a more radically pluralistic account where we kind of want to silo off these different human communities and cultural experiences, then yeah, you might want to be careful with some of those passages in Eckhart. But one quick quotation, just to back up what I was saying before. Here's a quotation. Here I'm kind of mixing together sermons 13a and 13b in Eckhart, where he essentially says that you should make no distinction in the family of men, or let's say the human family, and be as well disposed to a person across the sea as to your closest relative or closest neighbor. Another way that Eckhart likes to talk about this is the idea of shedding or getting rid of the this and that, right? And he says this and that all the time. Sometimes he uses names, you know, like German names. Like there should be no this or that. There should be no Hans or Jonas, right? And essentially what he seems to be saying there is get rid of particularity, right? Again, it goes back to the particular and the universal. It's like there should be no this and that. There should be no my town and their town. There should be no we speak middle high German and they speak middle low German and those people speak French and that's even worse, right? All of that should kind of be pushed off to the side, right? Detached from, to use the more technical language. And that could come at a cost, right? So again, I'm not necessarily saying this is all good all the way down or that it can't be co-opted in a bad way. I think it could, but it can also be read in a pretty liberating or emancipatory way, I think, right? If we connect it to modern forms of emancipatory universalism, in which the idea would not be to force a one-size-fits-all solution on every human community, but which would, again, just kind of break the chains and, again, emancipate us from all of these ideas that keep us apart and keep us locked up within ourselves. And I just think nationalism is probably the best modern example of that. And it's something that I think Eckhart, if we extrapolate him from the medieval to the modern, is a uniquely fruitful resource to kind of help us rethink.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I really love as a reader, but also find very frustrating as a historian, is that at a certain point, books belong to their readers, and the author's intentions can often be completely disconnected from what an audience interprets when they read the text. But that unfortunately means that sometimes people take an entire time period and decide to interpret it in their own way to support their trash opinions. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we can do as medievalist historians is to show that context, to put these things in the frame from which they came and say, you're hearkening back to a past that didn't exist and would have been really, really terrible. So get your hands off of our time period.
Right, right. Yes. And so, like I say, 200 years ago, we're already getting these modern nationalistic attempts to appropriate the medieval mystics. 100 years ago, we're getting explicitly fascist attempts. And guess what? Early 21st century, we're getting a new round of fascist attempts to appropriate the Middle Ages and again, kind of create this fake past that they can then use. And so the way we thought about it as we were working on the book is how can we push back against that in a way that is kind of open about what we're doing, right? So we're not saying here is a purely dispassionate scientific analysis of Eckhart's manuscripts. Like we're coming from a point of view and our point of view is largely defined by pushing back against what you and I have just isolated as a problem. But hopefully we're doing so in a way that does respect the serious historical scholarship and isn't just sort of cherry picking. Oh, here's a passage from Eckhart. Here's a passage from Eckhart that kind of suit our own dispositions. But is there a way that we can do the intellectual history, be responsible as historians of philosophy and theology, but also lay our cards on the table and be open about what exactly we're opposing by emphasizing some of these themes in Eckhart. And for example, doing something that is anachronistic, like using Eckhart in an anti-nationalistic way, definitely anachronistic. I'll cop to that. But I hope that the passages we're pointing to in Eckhart and that we're contextualizing in Eckhart will clearly be rooted in what Eckhart himself was up to, rather than we're just taking quotes out of context and creating that false past.
And I think it's really important that when we go into these broader discussions, we are transparent that, you know, we aren't operating in a vacuum and we do have our own opinions and agendas that we can't help but bring to the work that we do because we are only human. So it's really good to see that acknowledged, and obviously fighting against fascism is always a good idea. But thinking about this idea of these mystics being misused and taken out of context, is there a part of Eckhart's work that you see being misused or even that's just very overplayed at this point?
Well, I think that one of the passages that I see coming up the most, and often in the context of modern philosophical engagement with Eckhart's sermons, is this quotation about our sort of sharing of the same eye as God, right? And here I'm talking about EYE eyes, although there's all sorts of fun puns we could make about the eye with which we see and the eye that goes along with our selfhood. And I said before that there's this idea of sort of sharing a ground with God, and that's key to Eckhart. There's also, you know, another way of articulating that in terms of a sort of intellectual sight or vision. But the problem here is I worry sometimes that this is a passage that does get taken out of context and that sometimes is used more to make a point that the modern philosopher wants to make rather than to dig back into what Eckhart may have been trying to say. So the quotation from Eckhart as it passes through one very important modern philosopher, Hegel, is as follows. The eye with which God sees me is the eye with which I see God. My eye and God's eye are one. In justice, I am weighed in God, and God is weighed in me. If God were not, I would not be. If I were not, so God would not be. It is not, however, necessary to know this, since there are things which are easily misunderstood and which can only be grasped in the concept. All right, so that's already a loaded quote. You can see which elements might be a little controversial. And it even has this sort of meta quality where within the quotation itself, it's admitted that what has just been said could be taken in a sense that is completely different from the intended meaning. And so one way that some modern thinkers would read this quote, I think it would be reductive to say that Hegel does this, because I think Hegel's more interested in connecting to this idea of kenosis and self-emptying and kind of using that model to explain what happens with spirit or Geist. So let's set Hegel aside for now. But there are some modern readers who would see this quote and they would interpret it kind of as an elevation of the human subject. They would say, perhaps, that with a line like, if I were not, God would not be, we're sort of bringing the human up to the level of the divine, and even seeming to make the divine depend upon the human for its reality, for its very being. And I don't think that's exactly what Eckhart's going for, because what Eckhart's going for, as we've touched upon already, is not an elevation of the human subject to the level of the divine, but more a diminution, right? A lessening, an emptying out, an annihilating of human subjectivity or the self, such that nothing is really left over but the grunt we share with God, something like that. So it's not an elevation, but some folks, I think, want it to be an elevation because their sense of mystical experience is more about humanity becoming godlike, and again, a kind of valorized sense. And that's different, I would suggest, from Eckhart's attempt to kind of draw us down, right? To sort of humble us and force us to overcome these false idols we have of our own selves.
I really like that because it does fit in with this idea of getting rid of all of these constructions and categories. God, in terms of my individual human conception of what God is still a human conception. So needing to get rid of that as well makes sense with the overall process that Eckhart is talking about. So you need to free yourself from your own conceptions of what God is. Not necessarily that God as a being relies on your interpretation of them, but rather the opposite, that is a limiting factor. It's a limited understanding of the divine. I like that. We are coming to the end of time now, which means I've just got to ask you the final question of the podcast, which is, what is it that makes Eckhart your favorite mystic? Why do you like him so much and keep coming back to him?
I would say that what I find most compelling about Eckhart is that his critique of selfhood lends itself to concrete changes in our actual lived experience of the world, right? So the material immanent world of time and matter and ethics and labor, right? The actual work that we do. So you see this actually pop up in all sorts of interesting ways in Eckhart's sermons. One great example I always come back to is his rereading of Mary and Martha in Luke 10. So there's a certain expectation that Eckhart's audience probably would have had about why Mary is elevated above Martha in that scene, where Mary is sort of sitting at the feet of Christ, where Martha is engaged in busy work, right? She's running around the house trying to do all of this labor. And the audience might expect, okay, Eckhart's going to use his mystical rhetoric to explain why Mary's contemplation of the divine incarnate is superior to Martha, who's too attached to the material world, right? You might expect that that's what he's going to say. He doesn't say that. He flips it, right? He inverts the more common interpretation of that scene, and he makes Martha the hero to be emulated, not Mary, right? Mary stands in for a kind of idle contemplation. Martha stands in for the idea that you can undergo this sort of inner transformation that Eckhart's talking about with self-annihilation and kenosis and the ground and everything, and then go back out into the world, and that your engagement with the world will sort of be qualitatively transformed by this inner experience. But you're not leaving the world. You're still going to be engaged, but you're going to be engaged in a different way and in a better way, ideally. Now, I would say that that should pay dividends for ethics, right? The way that you ethically relate to other human beings will be different if you undergo this process of self-annihilation. And that's what we discussed when we talked about how Eckhart uses this idea that we should identify with people on the other side of the world just as much as the people who are close to us. That's an ethical transformation that you should be able to undergo if you pursue self-annihilation and kenosis. I would add to that, and this is a little more debatable, but I think it's true, that the way that you relate to your own labor, the way that you relate to your own daily work within and upon the material world, that also can undergo a sort of qualitative transformation through these same practices. And if I'm going to point to one last interesting connection or authority on that matter, I would suggest that people take another look at Max Weber's work on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. This is a work I find that a lot of people talk about, but fewer and fewer people have actually sat down and read it. If you look at it, you'll see that Weber actually likes to cite late medieval Dominican mystics like Johann Tauler, who's coming right after Eckhart in the same German Dominican tradition, and all of the things that folks like Tauler and Eckhart will say about work and how your relationship to your own daily labors can be transformed in this way. One last quotation that I think ties together these themes in Eckhart, the idea of overcoming the self, undergoing an ethical renewal that leads to a new relationship with the world, and connecting that to actual works that you do in that world, as a quotation from Sermon 3. So maybe I will end with that.
Absolutely. Let's have it.
God's purpose, says Eckhart, in the union of contemplation is fruitfulness in works. For in contemplation, you serve yourself alone, but in works of charity, you serve the many. And with that quote, I think what Eckhart is doing is he's trying to call us to be Marthas, not just Marys, but to be Marthas actively engaged in the world in a new sort of way.
Incredible. And Go Be Martha is a great slogan for literally anyone's life. Who doesn't love a confusing tagline? Sean, thank you so much for joining me today and for telling me all about Meister Eckhart.
Thank you for having me.
It was great having you. And thank you all for listening. Follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic. Send the podcast to someone if you think they'll enjoy it. And join me next time when I speak to W. Ezekiel Goggin about Georges Bataille.